because we were confused. I mean, I had this advance notice. I didn't have all the details, but I had this advance notice that he was going to be fasting, but I had no idea that he was going to announce it in this way or do it in this way or where he was going to do it. I had a certain level of responsibility in the movement at that point, and the primary one being that I was in charge of the 40 acres. I was in charge of 40 acres because I was the executive director of the National Farm Worker Service Center, which I founded. And I founded with Caesar's blessing, of course, at his request. But they held title. They're the ones that purchased the 40 acres. And we had built a co-op gas station that was soon to be open, but not yet open, on the 40 acres. And that is where Caesar walked to begin his fast. So I stood up and said that no one is permitted to drive on the 40 acres as long as Caesar is fasting. It is sacred ground, and we're not going to drive our cars onto sacred ground. Now, why I said that, where I got that idea, I don't know. But I did, and I said it, and I meant it, and that's the way it was. And the other thing I said was, after the fast started, I was the person in charge of the logistics of the fast, is the way it turned out. And that would be natural. I mean, I was a friend of Caesar's. I was close to him. I had this responsibility. He trusted me. But I said that Caesar will not give any interviews to the press while he is fasting. And the press is not permitted to take photographs of him while he is fasting. The exception being that every evening we had religious services. We had the Catholic Mass, which was open to the public, and farm workers came in droves, and people came from all over. And if the national press or the California press was there, they were welcome to take photographs, and they did, and had their TVs sometimes. But they were not permitted to interview Caesar or question him in any way, even though Caesar was present. That was not appropriate. This was not a public relations. This was not a publicity stunt. This was a religious fast. It had a purpose, and that was going to be respected.
But it must have caused so much controversy to say, my God, this guy is offering himself up as a Christ-like figure. I mean, was that, how did people respond to that? Not just the confusion, this, like, I don't know what you'd call it, you know.
Did Caesar come across as a Christ-like figure when he announced the fast? I don't think so. I don't think that was the issue. If anything, along those lines, I think people would have said, well, he's been reading Gandhi again. And Gandhi did it, and so Caesar wants to do it or thinks he should do it. I don't think the Christ-like figure ever played any role, and that wasn't what the shouting and the weeping and gnashing of teeth was about. It was about, we have work to do, we have a union to build, and you're their leader, you've left us, and you've gone off and do this fasting, and also the fact is that some people in the movement believed in violence as a way to win the strike. As long as Caesar was committed to nonviolence, they would respect that and they would follow that. But It frays around the edges when weeks and months, many months go by, and there's no sign of victory. There's no the boycott is there, but it takes a long time to make a boycott, there's good reason why Cesar Chavez decided that he had to do a fast for nonviolence, and he stepped up to the plate, and he figured out that's what he was going to do and how he was going to handle it, and that's what he did. And some people left. Some people left the movement at that point. Not many, but a few. Important people. I mean, the helpful people. It's not like... but they, it was too much for them.
Let's pause here.
Mark.
Yeah, just what you'd said. To get these major media figures to comply with the wishes of this farm worker leader, I mean, it was just phenomenal. Tell me about the Tom Brokaw stuff.
I insisted that as long as Caesar was fasting at the 40 acres, that he would not give any interviews and that no photographs would be permitted, would be taken of him during the fast. And even I can't believe it today, almost 50 years later, that the national press especially honored that. They respected what Cesar Chavez was attempting to do in the fast and his commitment to nonviolence. And you have to remember that Martin Luther King was on the national scene at the same time promulgating, working for nonviolence, advocating nonviolence. So this was a national issue. And here was a farm worker organizer, a farm worker leader, who was taking it upon himself to sacrifice his body in terms of fasting for the sake of something as important as nonviolence. And they respected that. Now, in this day and age, it would be out of the question. There would be no point in even advocating such a position because it would be disrespected, really. But that was another era, another time, another place, and there was more respect, and people's motives weren't always being questioned and trashed, and it was different.
Did the growers try to sort of somehow discredit, undermine his fast?
Oh, well, no. No. The growers themselves and their public relations people they couldn't cope with a public fast, a national public fast. They didn't attempt to trash it or... to speak out against it or question the motives. The ongoing position of the public relations people for the grower community was that Cesar Chavez was not a labor organizer. This was not a union. This was a social movement. It's true. It was a social movement. It's also true. It's a union, and it's a movement. But
So you guys must have been frightened. Cesar Chavez decides to stop eating. Obviously, as the days grow, the days pass, he must be getting weaker, and you guys must be getting concerned. Tell me about that concern, and what was he like during that period?
It was the first time that I've ever had the experience of being close to someone who stopped eating deliberately. And at first, the first couple of days, I didn't seem to notice anything. But then it wasn't long that I did notice a difference, that I just felt that he was just a little more withdrawn, not quite so chipper, seemed weaker to me. I was very concerned about how long was this going to go on. And I pressed Cesar several times early on, and he said he didn't know. He just didn't know. And so I had to accept that. And we had a doctor, Dr. Jerry Lackner, who was a volunteer doctor from San Jose and a longtime friend of the farm workers and friend of Cesar. And he came frequently to monitor Cesar. And Jerry Lackner is very level-headed, but he was very concerned. And every evening when he was there, when Dr. Lackner was there, he would give a report to the assembled group about his take on Cesar's health, what the exam showed, and his concern, and we were all concerned. But we didn't. What was there to do? I mean, we weren't in the driver's seat. Cesar Chavez was in the driver's seat because he was, first of all, the leader, and secondly, he was the one fasting, and only he could decide, or would decide, assuming he didn't die before then, that when he would begin eating again. So the tension built. There's no question about it. And when we got into the third week, I was really beside myself. I really felt that I began putting a lot of pressure on Cesar. Through our friendship, that I felt that he really needed to be careful and needed to take care of himself and, you know, think about what he was doing. And on the other hand, at the same time, hundreds of people, farm workers, were coming from all over California, from Arizona, from Oregon, from Washington, wanted to meet with Cesar, wanted to be a witness to this fast. Fasting meant something to them in their tradition, in their religion, in their culture. And a man who is willing to stop eating for the sake of other people, that is an important man. That's an important happening. That's something that needs to be noticed and needs to be witnessed. And they came. We had so many people arriving that we had to put up a tent city on the property. There were probably 60, 70 tents, at least, that we had set up. We had to provide an outdoor kitchen and dining facility for all of these people. They were guests. They came from afar. And they came for one purpose only, and that is to attend the Mass in the evening and to have an audience with Cesar during the day. And they stood in line during the day, and Cesar had personal audiences with maybe a group from Hollister, maybe a group from Willamette Valley, maybe a group from Phoenix. It turned out to be, it was one of those unintended consequences, really, where it became the greatest organizing tool that you could ever imagine. Where instead of the organizer and the leader going out to others, they were coming to him. It was amazing. And he took full advantage of it and really helped to cement the support of farm workers for their own union.
What would Caesar talk about? What would they talk about? How would the...
When people met with Caesar, farm workers I'm talking about, when they would meet with Cesar Chavez, they would explain to him the conditions, the working conditions, the suffering in their own communities, how they were treated as workers, and that things had to change, and what did he think about that, and what could happen, and what was the union about, and what was the purpose, and could he help them, and could the union help them, and... So it was like plotting and planning, so to speak, and in a nice way, they were offering themselves to help, and in a nice way, Caesar was reeling them in. I mean, they formed a sort of a mutual pact that they were all on the same page, and this all came about because of the fast, and I don't think Caesar ever pre-planned that. I know he didn't pre-plan that because he did not know what the response would be from anyone, let alone the farm workers. But they turned out en masse, and it culminated, of course, in the breaking of the fast at the Delano Park, where there were more than 5,000 people who attended.
Well, great. Let's set that up. Tell me about this. Was a huge because it became national. It attracted a national figure. So, tell me about how did you learn that Caesar was going to break the fast, and then what happens there? And build up the climax and the breaking of the fast.
Well, in I guess it was the fourth week. I got to the point where I put my foot down with Caesar, and I said, "Look, this can't go on. You've got to do something. This is too much." His health was fading. The doctors were concerned about it. Everyone was concerned about it, and he was noticeably weaker. And so I was bending down. He was lying down. I was bending down. And I was talking to him, and he said, "Leroy, you can't get the people until Sunday." I said, "Okay, Sunday it is." And that's how I knew that he was going to break the fast on Sunday, the upcoming Sunday. So I left the room, and we began to set into motion, getting ready for the breaking of the fast on Sunday afternoon. And people got in. People who part of the group, part of our organizing group, got in touch with Bobby Kennedy, who agreed to come. And he and Caesar, Bobby Kennedy and Caesar Chavez, had a previous working relationship, a respectful relationship. And Caesar Chavez believed that the Kennedy family in this country carried the torch for social justice. Now, I'm certain that that would apply to Bobby Kennedy. I'm not sure about the other Kennedys, but I don't know for sure. But Caesar was convinced that the Kennedy family in the United States of America carried the torch for social justice for poor people. So Sunday came, and we had a stage set up and had priests galore and nuns galore because they're going to celebrate the Mass and the breaking of the fast through the communion that was be held at the Mass. It was bedlam, organized bedlam. It wasn't confusion, but people were just thrilled, thrilled with everything, thrilled with the fact that he was going to end the fast. that this was a national event, that Senator Kennedy was there, that this validated, his presence validated their right to be treated as human being, a right to have a union, their right to have collective bargaining. All of those things came together. And it truly, truly was a glorious ending to what I thought became a pretty scary proposition in terms of the health of Cesar Chavez.
It's positive we said it. Well, let's shift gears a little bit because you brought something up that, you know, Cesar was a Diet Coke fiend. And that's funny. I mean, and we talked a little bit, you know, we're almost going there. Tell me a funny, if you can now think of a funny story that you think the public wouldn't expect Cesar to have done or said, but something insight into his, the lighter side and his humorous character, and people wouldn't figure, well, yeah, sometimes it can have a foul mouth. And can you think of a story that could illustrate this sort of the human side of Cesar?
Cesar Chavez had a sense of humor. For one thing, he never took himself too seriously and was always the first one to point out his own foibles. And he had a little mischievous smile sort of around the... When he was funning someone or when he was about to sort of mislead them, so to speak. I mean, in a not a mean way, if you know, a fun way, in other words. But you could see the sort of the little on the edge of the lips, a little curl, and you knew that he was cooking up something, you know. He wasn't a joke teller at all. I think he appreciated a good joke kind of thing, or maybe a play on words or something. But he had a marvelous facility for understanding human nature. And he accepted people for who they were, including their weaknesses. And that was not a turnoff for him. He understood that people have weaknesses and they have strong points. And he was interested in the strong points. He was interested in your commitment to the cause and what you brought to the cause. And less concerned, maybe not even any concern about maybe a personal weakness or a failing kind of thing. I mean, that in his view, your positive side trumped your inevitable negative side. Because we all have it. We all have our positives. We all have our negatives. And I always marveled at that. For example, people with some prison history in their background, whatever. It wasn't a concern with him. He was more interested in what they brought to the movement, what they brought, you know, the positive thing. He accepted the fact that some people drink too much. I never saw him drink too much, ever. But he didn't like hold it against you kind of thing, that if on occasion you did drink too much, you weren't in Cesar Chavez's doghouse. You were in his doghouse if you were not committed to the movement and if you were not doing everything that you possibly could to push the movement forward. It was very adamant about that.
Is that possibly holding people up to what might be an unreasonable standard? Did he hold people up to an unreasonable standard?
I think the Cesar Chavez held people to high standards in terms of their work, in terms of their willingness to work for the cause. For example, we did not take days off. The days off were not a regularly scheduled program. Now, that doesn't mean to say, for example, that people did not take a Sunday off, or, for example, or that it was a lighter work day. But what Caesar could not abide was laziness, or people who pretended to be working but really were slacking off. That bothered him. And we lost some volunteers because of that. I mean, they meant well. They came with high purpose. But they didn't want to do the work. And it's only doing the work, and that's what organizing is about. It's doing the work. And that's what makes things happen. It's not wishing that they're going to be done. It's not talking revolutionary lingo that gets something done. It's not attending meetings that gets something done. It's actually doing something. And picket line work is hard work. Hard, hard work. Boycotting is hard, hard work. And yet, if you're willing to do it day by day by day, it pays off. If you're not willing to do it, nothing's going to happen. So it was a high standard. But if you wanted to work and did work, didn't seem such a high standard to me. The other thing I always appreciated is that when Cesar Chavez gave you an assignment, and this could give me an assignment or give a boycotter an assignment kind of thing, he wasn't one to look over your shoulder and say, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. He counted on you to figure out a way to move the ball forward, that you knew what the goal was. You were given the assignment. You accepted the assignment. Now figure it out. And if you have questions, ask questions. But he didn't have time, nor did he take the time to, do you know what you're doing? And don't you think you should do it this way? And as a result, of course, he was rewarded 1,000 times over with people who were creative and who were left to their own devices and left their own resources, did it far, far better than he could have done it, for example, himself. So
he wasn't what we call today a micromanager.
No.
But what were some, I don't want people to fully to think that he was, though, a saint. Did he have weaknesses? Was he unbearably stubborn? Was he, a fighter to the point of fault? What were some of his sort of weaknesses and not so favorable traits?
Cesar Chavez was not a saint. He was a human being like the rest of us. But he lived a total life of commitment to the cause that he believed in. And most of us cannot do that. We can do it for a time. We all did it for a time, some longer than others. But only a person like Cesar Chavez, who is called to this work, can devote his entire life to it, which he did, 31 years of doing this kind of work. Now, he was a very stubborn person. Now, that has its upside and it has its downside. It depends what you're being stubborn about. For example, he was very stubborn about money. The money that came to the union, either through dues or contributions, whatever, he felt was sacred money and could only be used for the purposes for which it was given. So any misuse of money, any hint of a misuse of money, any sniff of a misuse of money drove him crazy. He would not tolerate it. Never did.
Did he ever swear?
Did Cesar Chavez swear? Well, not on my watch. He didn't swear. Maybe later on, as the movement grew and got bigger and bigger and more bureaucratic, maybe he did swear. I don't know. I wasn't there. But Cesar Chavez was a very soft-spoken, intense person. He was a wonderful listener. When you talked to him, you were the center of attention and the only center of attention. If you were speaking, he didn't interrupt you. He didn't anticipate your question and give you the question so he could give you the answer so you could get moving or so that he could get moving. No. No. He listened. And I think that this was an acquired skill that he learned through community organizing over the years. I don't think most people grow up being such a dedicated listener, but he learned by listening. And he would take what you were saying or trying to say, and he would massage that himself and come up with something that was new or slightly new.
You know, in the last couple of years or several years, it seems that there have been people writing about and discussing, you know, being very critical of Cesar. And I know what they're talking about, a period that you didn't work, weren't involved in the movement. But in my work in trying to make a film about him, I'm grappling, like, how do I make sense of this revisiting of Cesar's character? Or what do you make of this, what people are writing about and talking about in the last several years, being very critical of Cesar? How do you make sense of that?
Well, first of all, if you're going to talk about Cesar Chavez in any meaningful way, you have to hold simultaneously two concepts in your mind, and you can never let go of either one of them. And yet, they're not mergeable, really. Are we a union, or are we a movement? And he asked that question endlessly, from the first days I knew him until the last days I knew him, at community meetings or staff meetings or board meetings or planning meetings, whatever. Are we a union or are we a movement? The answer is we are both. But it's hard to... It's some people who I now call revisionists, they want to say it was a union. That's all there is to it. And Cesar Chavez did didn't do enough on the Union side. Now, others say maybe, well, it's a movement. And so they minimize the Union side and highlight the movement side. But I don't think that ever left Cesar Chavez, Union or movement. And his attitude deep down was, we are both. And sometimes I have to emphasize the Union side, and sometimes I have to emphasize the movement side, but I am not a labor leader, a traditional labor leader. I do not want to build a union that only is concerned about the members of the union and whether they get newer cars or bigger homes or... I want to build a movement that's part of the union that will be work on behalf of other workers and poor people, to raise them up, to empower them. But I'm not going to spend a lifetime building a union to put a few more dollars into a person's pocket and that's the end of it. There's more to life than that. There's more to life than making money. Now, these are difficult words. I mean, and they don't always fit easily together, these concepts. And some people see one thing, some people see another. For me, it's not much of a problem because from the first time I met Cesar Chavez, he made it very clear to me, and it resonated with me, that we are more than a labor union. I want to see co-ops where people are helping people through their purchasing power. I want to see credit unions. I want to, which is really another form of co-op. And I want to see satellite places where we can organize on behalf of poor people that have nothing to do with farm labor, but they have the backing of a farm worker labor union to make it possible. Now, some of those dreams, some of those ideals were met to a certain extent, met to a great extent. Others were not. What can I say? I mean, he spent his life doing it. He did what he could do. And now, frankly, it's for those who come behind him to do what they can do. And
very last question. And what do you think is his legacy or his impact on humanity or on society? What is Cesar's, Chavez's, where is his place in history? What is his impact on humanity? What is his legacy?
Cesar Chavez's legacy will, in my opinion, in my view, will resonate for several hundred years, long after I'm gone and those of us here are gone, because when you come across a person who lives a life dedicated to others, gives up all possessions. When Cesar Chavez died, he had a pair of shoes, he had some underwear, the clothes he was wearing, his eyeglasses, and a few books that he was reading or had collected over the years that he read. Now, that was his physical legacy. That was what his family inherited, so to speak. But But his legacy is one of a commitment to social justice, that and doing what is required to fulfill that commitment, which is living a life dedicated to that commitment and only to that commitment. Now, as I said earlier, you could live several lifetimes and not meet such a kind of person as Cesar Chavez with this kind of a commitment. But the fact is, in the second half of the 20th century, that man lived in our country, and he transformed an entire generation of people, empowered them. Let me give you an example. When Cesar Chavez started the National Farm Workers Association, there were less, in the state of California, there were less than 12, far less than 12, elected Latino leaders in the state. When he died, there were 800. And he had a direct and indirect influence on the election of each and every one of those Latino leaders. And they know it, and they understand it. And without him, it would not have happened. Now, is that proof positive that how one person can empower a whole generation of people? And that's not going to go away.
I guess that says it.
Well, it says it for me.
Levi, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have to go water my garden.
Yeah.